From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Great to see you. Thank you. Oh, you are nice. Listen, this week, we are turning over our show to the funniest people we know. Oh, since we will not be bringing you Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, let's make it the funniest people we know on purpose.
We start with Jeff Garlin, who's known as a comedian's comedian, which means a comedian another comedian keeps as a pet.
No. Carl, it actually means somebody that other comedians find really funny. Jeff joined us in September 2013 along with Paula, Roy, and Jesse Klein.
It is truly, truly no exaggeration, an honor to be on your fine program.
You are so nice, Jeff. So you've been really busy. Curb Your Enthusiasm is in hiatus now after how many seasons?
10, I believe.
Oh,
I don't remember.
And so now you've got a sitcom, a network sitcom.
Yes, called The Goldbergs.
That's awesome. And it is basically my childhood stolen from me.
Yeah, it is an 80s childhood. It was a family in Philadelphia in the mid-80s. It's based on the guy who wrote the show, Adam Goldberg. It's based on his life, and it's really fun and funny. And my character is kind of like a Ralph Cramden, Archie Bunker guy.
Now, wait a minute. So this guy, whose name is Goldberg, wrote a TV show about his own childhood called The Goldbergs.
Yes.
Aren't you supposed to at least to change the name and this sort of thing?
Well, actually, the network insisted that we call it The Goldbergs. And I got to tell you, they were a little bit hesitant, you know, because a Jewish family. And I said, let's just dive into the Jewish pool.
Right, just go there.
Don't dip the toe, dive in, we're Jews!
Well, is it because you were alive during the 80s, as was I, is it weird to go back to the 80s?
Well, no, because the show is pretend.
Oh, so you're not actually using some kind of time travel to go back to the 80s.
I graduated in 1980, high school.
Yeah.
I became a comedian in 1982.
Yeah.
So, and I lost my virginity in the 80s. So the 80s was an interesting time for me.
Right. And going back to the 80s, were you able to find your virginity again, or is it gone?
No, it's on a set over at Sony Studios.
Really?
Yeah.
You have kids yourself, obviously. How old are your kids?
13 and 17.
Right. And so have you have any experience from being a real-life dad that you can apply to playing a TV dad?
No, man. I just read my lines and I do it.
Really? You're not one of those.
Not only that, but the character I play is not a dad that would kiss his kids. I play a character very different from myself.
Really?
Yeah.
I understand that's called acting.
Yes.
Now, you also have a movie called Dealing with Idiots.
Dealing with Idiots, which you can see on, like, iTunes and Amazon and all that stuff. It's about youth baseball parents. Just the parents, not the kids.
Is this an autobiographical story?
Semi-autobiographical, yes. It's all, everyone, every adult in the movie is or becomes an idiot.
Really?
Yes.
Does that include yourself?
That includes myself.
I see. And I understand it's got a lot of your friends, like Bob Odenkirk and all those guys. And you said to them, hey, I'm doing a movie called Dealing with Idiots, and I want you in it.
Yes!
And they all said, sure!
They all said, sure, and they said, I hope I get to be an idiot.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you this, because I said earlier that most people heard of you when you started doing Curb Your Enthusiasm some time ago, but you were a working actor for a long time before that, and we were looking through some of your credits, and we found one that surprised me. You were on Baywatch?
I was a villain on Baywatch. I was an evil disc jockey who took over the beach.
How does a disc jockey take over a beach?
He offers up a gold doubloon, and he makes people do crazy things for the gold doubloon. Here's the thing. Yeah. It's the best acting I've ever done and the worst acting I've ever done. What I mean by that is I'm not good enough to rise above bad material as an actor. I'm just not. However, as bad as you think I am when you see me on Baywatch, every scene with David Hasselhoff, I did not laugh.
So David Hasselhoff would come up to you and say in his Hasselhoffian way, hey, take your gold doubloon and get off our beach. And you'd be
he was actually like in my face screaming, get out of here, get out of the beach. And every time his finger's in my face, all I'm thinking in my head is, you're David Hasselhoff!
You don't care about David Hasselhoff. Did you get to work with Pamela Anderson?
I did. I had a fantasy scene with Pamela Anderson.
What do you mean by fantasy scene?
Well, we were running on a beach, and I'm running towards her. She's running towards me, and we just reach each other, and I wake up from my fantasy. However, in the script, which I was very anxious about, it was written that she and I start kissing.
Yeah.
And it was the first day of filming. She didn't know me, and she didn't want to kiss me.
Oh.
So, all good, because like the end of the week, at the end of filming, where I got to know her and I made her laugh and what have you, she said, I would have totally made out with you now. And then I thought to myself years later, I'm so happy it worked out the way it did.
Why? That's a story you can tell late in life.
I don't want to tell that story. She's a beautiful woman, but I don't want... I mean, she's had Kid Rock.
That's true.
You know, I actually was with Kid Rock when he sang... take me out to the ball game at Wrigley Field.
Really? That's awesome.
Yes, and I was up in the booth, and they asked me to, like, help him because he hadn't done it before, and I'd done it. So anyhow, he's finished singing, and and then I whisper to him, yell, let's get some runs. What? Yell, let's get some runs. All right. Hey, Chicago, let's get some lunch.
That explains a lot of the Cubs' problems, doesn't it?
I mean, the Cubs were going to mount a comeback, but Kid Rock just told us to get lunch. Well, let's go. Well, Jeff Garland, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, but we've asked you here this time to play a game we're calling...
You have served the cause of science and also of providing this show with material.
Every year...
Do you know how much I love... when he does that every week.
I do, too. I get to listen every week. Yeah. Every year, the Journal of Improbable Research gives out its Ig Nobel Prizes for groundbreaking and very real scientific research into neglected areas of knowledge. They held their ceremony last week in Cambridge, and so this week we're going to ask you about three new Ig Nobel Prize winners. Get two right, you'll win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl's Voice. Are you ready to play, Jeff?
I am so ready. I've never been more ready for anything in my life.
All right. Good then. Carl, who is Jeff Garland playing for?
Jeff is playing for Sarah Burkhart of Elgin, Illinois.
All right.
You're kidding me! Sarah Burkhart of Elgin,
yes!
Oh, my God. Let's get this party started.
First question. The Ig Nobel Prize in Probability Research went to a study that determined, quote, A, that if a woodchuck could chuck wood, it wouldn't chuck very much wood at all. B, that if I told you you had a beautiful body, you would not, in fact, hold it against me. Or C, that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely a cow will soon stand up. And once a cow stands up, you cannot easily predict how soon the cow will lie down again.
I would go with C.
You're going to choose C, the cow study?
Yes.
It's true. These guys studied cows. They observed them for days.
Yay!
And they found out that how long a cow has been standing has no effect on when it will lie down, but not vice versa. All right. Very good.
Thank goodness someone got to the bottom of that.
Yeah, I know. Next question. This year, the Ig Nobel Prize in Psychology went to a team that proved that what actually exists? A, reverse beer goggles. B, multiple chin syndrome. Or C, implanted false memories of having false memories of false memories.
I'll go, once again, go with C.
You're going to go for implanted false memories of having false memories of false memories?
Yes.
No, it was the beer goggles. They proved that not only do drunk people think that they themselves are more attractive than they really are, but it works even if they're not really drunk. The title of the paper was called Beauty is in the Eye of the Beer Holder. And we all heard about beer goggles. You have a lot of beer, people start looking more attractive.
Oh.
Reverse beer goggles is that when you've had a lot to drink, you think yourself is more attractive than you actually are. And further, this is really interesting. They found out this is true even if you're not drunk, but you think you are. All right, this is exciting, Jeff, because if you get this last one, you win. The 2013 Safety Engineering Prize went to the late Gustano Pizzo for something he invented back in 1972. He's finally getting credit for it. What did he invent back in 72? A safety engineering device. Was it A, an anti-hijacking system, which would seal a hijacker in a package and then drop the package through trap doors on the airplane? B, a secondary helmet cyclists could wear to protect their original helmet? Or C, a seatbelt to protect people who sit in Lazy Boys from being ejected when they return the Lazy Boy to the upright position?
I am going to go with A.
You're going to go with A, the anti-hijacking system.
Yeah.
And you'd be right.
Wow.
You may remember, hijacking was a big problem in the early 70s. The idea was you just make the hijacker stand on the X, stand right there, pull the lever, gets encapsulated, gets dropped with a parachute for easy collection later. Carl, how did Jeff Garland do in our quiz?
Jeff, you had two correct answers, so you win for Susan Burkhart.
Right. Very good. Jeff Garland stars in ABC's comedy The Goldbergs. You should also check out his latest movie, Dealing with Idiots. You can download it or stream it. Jeff Garland, thank you so much for joining with us. Always so much fun to talk to you. Bye-bye, Jeff.
Looks good, good, good. Billy's got his beer goggles on.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. Here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Listen. This week we are just bringing the funny. Well, technically we're not bringing it ourselves, but we've invited people who are funny to bring it. We're bringing the bringers of the funny.
Next up, author, collector of all the world's knowledge, Daily Show correspondent, and Ayn Rand impersonator, John Hodgman.
John joined us back in November of 2011 along with Paula, Paul Prevenza, and Amy Dickinson. Now, it is extraordinary to the extent to which you have become ubiquitous everywhere. You cannot not only turn on your TV, but your computer. You keep popping up on my computer in internet ads, which is disconcerting.
Yes. Well, I enjoy watching you while you work.
Thank you. But here is, I'm going to get to this. I turn on my TV, I don't see you. I see a guy that Microsoft has hired who looks like you, who they are putting up as a defense against the implied slander of your ads.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Come on. You must have seen this.
I don't watch television, you know me. It's certainly not ads. I loathe advertising.
I know. But there's a guy at Microsoft who got a job in an ad because he looks like you.
Yes, I've heard tell of such things.
I'm
very happy for him. You know, as somebody who has an accidental television career,
right.
I'm happy to see that happen to somebody else.
I see your
on
point.
Purpose.
That is so one world view.
How, and you talk about this a bit in your book, how has being a famous minor television personality, as you put it, affected your daily life, John?
Well, you may notice I'm wearing a tuxedo.
That is exciting.
Yes, very nice.
I always dress up for radio. I'm rather surprised to see that you people are not wearing tuxedos.
That's, you know why? These guys dress up to listen at home.
That's right.
That's how fancy they are.
They often come in pajamas, John. Count yourself lucky. But now, because you're a literary guy and author of books, and now you walk around the streets of New York City, and I presume people go nuts to
yes,
see you.
Yes, I used to enjoy the anonymity of being a literary figure and occasionally a public radio figure.
Yes.
But now people come up to me and they point. Or they will often say, you look like the guy in those ads.
And when do you, what do you say on that occasion?
There's a reason for that. The fact is, I'm very self-similar. I am fractal-like.
Yes, I see.
Thank you, nerds.
Let us talk about the areas of your expertise,
yes,
of which are immense. Because
that was my old book. That was the old technology.
I'm sorry, but now we've moved on to
the new technology. The upgrade is entitled More Information Than You Require.
See, here's the thing. Your book, as you confess right up, it's all made up.
It is a book of trivia, much like the old Ripley's Believe It or Not or the Book of Lists, with the advantage that all of the amazing true facts in my book are made up by me.
I wish you had told me that before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can't tell you how many bets I've lost.
Well, then I better not tell you how many I've won. You should really stop betting with me on subjects covered in my own book.
You actually
wise.
Have a section on bar bets, actually.
Yes, I do, absolutely. For example, do you know how you? It's called a proposition bet.
Yes.
You go into a bar, and you find someone who's having a drink with their friends, and you interrupt them, and you say, "I bet I can make this match land on its end."
Right.
And then, if they don't hit you, you have a chance to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the trick. This is what you do. You take the match and you attach a little parachute to it and put some glue on the bottom of it. And you preset that in your jacket.
Right.
And you throw it up in the air. And I would say 2 times out of 10 it works.
I'll have to try that. I was also intrigued and somewhat frightened by your explanation of the tradition of eating oysters.
Oh, yes. Oysters. Well, let me tell you. If you enjoy a food that tastes like snot after it has been rubbed on rocks and old silverware.
Yes.
Then you may enjoy oysters. But do not listen to the killjoys who tell you never to eat oysters in months that do not contain the letter R, May, June, July, August, October. You know. They say that you should not eat oysters during those months because they are the warm months. They are the traditional spawning season of the oyster. And that, of course, is when the oyster tends to beg for its life while you're eating it, which some people find distracting or embarrassing for the oyster. But I say, if you're going to eat a creature alive, you have to expect some screaming. That is the, that is the carnivore's burden.
Don't you think? Well, John Hodgman, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
So you're a PC, huh? We'll see about that.
So you play a PC in
yes,
the commercials.
That is accurate.
But we've been watching them for a while, and we are beginning to suspect you're not really a PC at all. In fact, we think you're
I'm not a computer.
No,
that is correct.
We think, in fact, you're a cruel parody of the actual machine as created by its enemies. So we're going to ask you 3 questions about the history of the Microsoft Corporation. Get 2 of these questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. Carl, who is John Hodgman playing for?
John is playing for Ron Blackmore of Madison, New York.
All right.
I'm very sorry, Ron.
All right. First question. In 1976, the young company launched its first print advertisement in a technical journal called Digital Design. What was this advertisement? Was it A picture of the young Bill Gates with his shaggy hair and aviator glasses and the slogan, "He's a stud"? B, a 4-panel comic strip relating, quote, "the legend of the micro kid"? Or C, a densely written description of its proprietary version of the basic computer language written specifically for the Altair personal computer?
I will say C, and here's the reason why.
Please.
Because, you know, I naturally own a lot of very old magazines. And I enjoy going to old magazines because the advertisements in those magazines tended to have thousands of words of copy in them.
They did.
Isn't that strange? For a video game, they would describe it in thousands of words. I mean, they were very wordy at the time. So that's why I'm going to say C.
I love your explanation, but in fact,
No one loved my explanation. Don't lie to me.
I'm just trying to make you feel better. The answer was B. It was a 4-panel comic strip.
Oh.
The Adventures of the Micro Kid. He was a boxer, you see. He had speed and power and needed a manager, say a kind of operating system, in order to succeed.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I lost. Sorry about that.
No. You still have 2 more chances.
Oh, okay. Very well.
Once Microsoft got going in the early 80s, it needed a corporate symbol, and it found one. A logo known in the industry as what? A, the blibbit. B, the all-seeing eye. Or C, the exploding head.
The blibbit.
The blibbit?
Yes.
You're right, sir. The blibbit. The blibbit looked like an O drawn with horizontal lines and lasted a few years. All right, this is very exciting.
This is the tiebreaker?
This is the tiebreaker. You get this right, yeah, you win.
I look forward to that.
Microsoft was challenged in its earliest days by another upstart company you might have heard of, Apple.
Microsoft. I hear they're very good.
Yeah, well. Microsoft considered Apple, though, to be evil based on what very real evidence? A, if you typed a certain string of characters into the Apple I computer, it replied, "All hail Satan, all hail Satan."
They call that an Easter egg.
Yes.
B, ironic, isn't it?
B, the original price of the Apple I was $666.66. Or C, the original code name for the project that became the Macintosh, Lucifer.
The answer is B.
The answer is B. The original price was $666.66.
That is my final answer.
You are correct, sir. Very well done. Steve Jobs explained that he thought $666.66 would be an easy number to remember. I have to ask, you were so confident. Is that because as an Apple advertisement to yourself, you're up on the history of Apples, or did you just happen to know?
I don't wish to brag, but I'm very intelligent. And I did, very luckily, happen to know the answer to that question.
That's amazing. Carl, how did John Hodgman do in our quiz?
Well, John's intelligence was on display here, Peter. He had two correct answers, so he wins for Ron Blackmore.
Well done! A remarkable display of last-minute brilliance.
I'm just glad for Ron Blackmore.
As are we. John Hodgman is a correspondent for The Daily Show. He's the PC on those I'm a Mac and a PC commercials. He is also the author of the excellent, hilariously funny new book, More Information Than You Require. John Hodgman! Thank you so much for joining us. The funniest, most subversive TV comedy ever isn't South Park or any of the strange shows on Adult Swim. It's Strangers with Candy.
The show ran on Comedy Central for just two seasons, 14 years ago. And one of the stars was Amy Sedaris, who played a woman in her 40s who goes back to high school.
Amy joined us in 2006 to talk about that show and her popular books on entertaining. Here she is with panelists Charlie, Amy, and Mo.
Because when you invite someone into your home, be it a dealer or boyfriend, whatever, you're saying, I like you.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
that's why.
I understand.
And so, Under the Influence is about, you know, I was influenced by Girl Scouts and Junior Achievements and my second first grade teacher, you know, all the things that I've been, you know, influenced by. And then I have a whole chapter on how, what a pain in the butt it is to entertain people who do get drunk or really messed up on something, how they can single-handedly bring your party to a screaming halt. Because they always think of the life of the party, but really they bring it down.
Now, I noticed, I was leafing through the book, and I noticed it has many recipes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And
lots of pictures and large print.
Oh, yeah, lots of pictures and large print. I'm sure you did.
I really kept the illiterate in mind because a lot of people who can't read, that's one thing, and then there are a lot of people who just don't know how to read. So I wanted to do a visual book so that when they saw the picture, it would inspire them to write their own story in their head.
Right. Do you advise? I mean, are these real recipes? If I make these recipes?
Yeah, I took it seriously. A lot of the humor came from Paul Dinello making fun of the fact that I was trying to be serious. So I decided to make it a little bit more entertaining than I originally wanted to. Because I just don't like joke cookbooks. And it would just go into a wacky pile and nobody would take it seriously. So it's all real.
Including, like, your list of munchies?
Munchies! Yeah, that was a hard list to come up with.
Yeah, I could tell. Cause
someone thought I was holding a hummingbird feeder in that picture, and it's a bong, and it's so funny to me. I'm like, why would I be holding a hummingbird feeder looking like that? That's so funny to me.
I mean, the list starts
that
out okay.
That could explain why the hummingbirds fly upside down and backwards in my yard.
Yeah.
I thought it was a hummingbird feeder when I found it in the garage.
No, they got some good chronic. That's what it is.
Forgotten I owned that.
Well, Amy Sedaris, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Drinking This Much will either win me a Pulitzer Prize or make not winning a lot easier to take.
Not all great writers are drinkers, but certainly it often seems that way. We recently came across a book called Hemingway and Bailey's Bartending Guide.
Wow.
It's a book of anecdotes and cocktail recipes from the country's famous authors. We'll ask you three questions about the drinking habits of literary geniuses in history.
Okay.
Get two questions right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Wow, okay.
Okay, so Carl, who is Amy Sedaris playing for?
Amy is playing for David Tuttle of Arcata, California.
Okay.
All right, ready?
Yes.
Here we go. Here's your first question. There are big drinkers, and then there's Jack Kerouac. The author of On the Road once got so drunk he did what? A, he roasted, cut up, and ate a Goodyear truck tire. B, he enlisted in the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines on the same day. Or C, he got married to a 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
Oh, they're all so good. Sophie's choice. I'm going to say three.
You're going to say he got married to that 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
It's not true. I'm going to say three, but I bet it's two.
Ooh. Well, which are you going to say? I want you to.
I am saying three, but I bet it's two.
I don't know what this says about you. It is the second choice. It's B.
Yeah,
yes.
It is. Yeah.
It was the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines.
I knew it.
So why didn't you?
That's what I would do. I would get on a line. You know, when you're like that, and you just call everybody. But I don't know. I like the idea of three, but I knew it was two.
All right. Yeah, he did. He enlisted on the same day into the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. Strangely, by the time he sobered up, he was on board a ship headed for Greenland. He was in the Merchant Marine. Mm.
So, I know I lost it, but
No, you have two more chances if you get the next
it was
two right.
It was a choice to lose.
If you get two more right, you will win, so don't
okay.
lose hope. Here we go. Author Sherwood Anderson died from drinking, not in the way, though, you
ha-ha,
might
ha-ha, that's
think.
Hilarious. Go on.
But he did not die in the way you might think. What finally did him in? Was it A, he realized his newly bought bottle of scotch was Johnny Walker Red, not black. He turned around to go return it and was hit by a truck. B, he was talking and drinking and eating at a shipboard cocktail party and he swallowed a toothpick. Or C, he suggested to a sailor that drinking creme de menthe was, quote, sort of a namby-pamby thing to do, is it not, unquote.
It was two.
The toothpick?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
I was going to say toothpick of our campaign, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
Toothpick is very dangerous. I know that.
Yeah, and he
that
died.
And campaign button.
Have you swallowed a campaign button?
No, not yet.
Okay, you've gotten one right. You've gotten one right. Well, anyway, that is how Sherwood Anderson died. He swallowed a toothpick, it gave him peritonitis, and he passed away. It's true. If you get this last question correct, Amy, you will, in fact, win. Here we go.
Wow, I never win anything.
Well, you might win this. Last question. Thomas Wolfe, the author, of course, of You Can't Go Home Again, Look Homeward, Angel. He could be alarming as a drinking buddy. Why? A, he liked to bite off parts of his glass and chew on them. B, when he ran out of liquor in the middle of the night, he would break into friends' homes and drink theirs. Or C, he liked to challenge people to a drinking game called I Can Down Any Bottle of Any Booze in 60 Seconds.
He sounds like a terrible guest.
Is he saying anybody? I know he's dead. Let's see. Gosh, okay, chewing the glass, which, okay, that's a possibility. I'm going to say three.
You're going to go with C, that choice.
It's not C. I can tell by you're disappointed in my choice.
No, I was just trying to build up some dramatic tension. I wasn't trying to interrupt.
Well, you're
one
doing a
another.
Good job. All now right. I'm depressed.
But that is your choice, C.
Yeah, but I bet it's one. What is it?
Yes, it was one, I'm afraid. Yes.
You know why I thought it was one? Because my brother David had this Ronco glass cutter, and he would take our wine bottles and make them into glasses, but he would never sand the edges, so when we would drink from the glass, we would all cut our lips.
Oh.
And that's why I thought it was believable. But damn it, I picked C.
Yeah, you did.
Jeez.
And he did like, Thomas Wolfe apparently did like to chew glass. We don't know why.
Wow.
But he did.
Well, I guess I'm a loser.
Well, let's find out, Carl. How did Amy Sedaris do in our quiz?
Well, she said it. To make it official, Amy needed two correct answers at least to win. She had just one correct answer.
Gee, I know. We all know. Why repeat it? Now I'm depressed.
No. Amy Sedaris is a comedian, actress, and author of the new book, I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. Amy Sedaris, thank you so much
thank
for joining
us. Thank you so
us.
Much, you guys.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. You guys are great. Tig Notaro was just another working comedian in Los Angeles, which he performed what instantly became the most famous comedy act of the year, a monologue about a series of terrible events, including her mother's death and her own cancer diagnosis. She put it out as a recording called Live, and we listened to it before talking to her in July of 2013.
But you know what's nice about all of this is that you can always rest assured that God never gives you more than you can handle. Never. Never. When you've had it, God goes, all right, that's it. I just keep picturing God going, you know what? I think she can take a little more. And then the angels are standing back going, God, what are you doing? You are out of your mind. And God was like, no, no, no. I really think she can handle this.
Did you have to do the thing that comedians do? Just, I'm going to write some jokes about cancer. Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, I was diagnosed on July 25th, and the show was August 3rd, and so I didn't find anything funny from, you know, from my hospitalization and my mother's death and my breakup. I just wasn't in a lighthearted mood, really. And then once I was diagnosed with cancer, I was like, okay, everything became hilarious to me. It just was so...
A lot has happened. I mean, I have to say, this is like, this getting cancer thing was like one of the best things that's happened to you professionally.
It really is.
I mean, are other comedians out there going, damn, why can't I get cancer? Because
I know. I when people ask, how'd you do it? What do you suggest in comedy? And I'm like, just get cancer and every other possible thing, you know, that you can get. And then book a show at Largo and get Louis C.K. on the show.
It's worked for you. And I have to ask, how's your health?
I'm in remission.
Yay.
And I'm feeling good, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. I want to ask you, has anything strange happened to you now that you've become known, God forbid, that this is continuing as like the comedian who did the thing about cancer?
The weirdest thing is that nothing weird has really happened. And, I feel like strangers think they know me, but in a very kind way, and they know so much personal stuff about me. And I always tell this story about when I was in New York this last time, and I was going across the street, and this woman came up, and she said, I know you have trouble with your digestive tract, and you have some food issues, but this restaurant right across the street is just absolutely wonderful. You should check it out. And then she just wandered off. I was like, thank you. Thank you.
So you're kind of known for creating awkward moments when you're on
sure.
stage.
Yeah.
Like you'll push a chair around for 2 minutes.
Yeah, ideally longer than 2 minutes.
Yeah, 2 minutes is for amateurs. She goes for the half hour.
Yeah. But are you and just not like the rest of us? Like, are you totally cool with awkwardness? Are you great on first dates?
I'm horrible on first through 100. The first 100 dates, I'm really not good.
How are you bad on a date?
I'm awkward in not a fun way. I've gone out with somebody where they couldn't believe I was a comedian. They were just looking at me so confused.
Really?
So that, yeah, I'm awkward like that, but then in comedy I feel very comfortable when the awkwardness follows me on stage. That's my element where I'm like, oh, this feels right.
So in those moments where any other comedian, as Faith says, we're all kind of nervous, are standing there looking at an audience and just like, oh my God, nothing's happening, I feel like killing myself, you're like, this is right.
Oh yeah, if I was on stage and nothing was happening, I would feel like I had made it finally.
Really? Okay, Tig Notaro, we've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Tig, meet Tug.
Frank Edwin McGraw, known as Tug McGraw, was one of the great relief pitchers in baseball, or at least one of the most colorful. We're going to ask you three questions about your near namesake, Tug McGraw. If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their voicemail. Carl, who is comedian Tig Notaro playing for?
Tig is playing for Jeremy Meyer of Tempe, Arizona.
Ready to go?
Yeah, if it matters at all, I know who Tug McGraw is.
That's great. Okay, here we go. How did Tug McGraw get his nickname? Was A, as a boy, he liked to pull larger boys through the playground like a tugboat. B, it was a compromise between his mother's choice of name Tim and his father's Doug. Or C, his mother nicknamed him Tug because of his aggressive breastfeeding.
I'm going to go with the first option.
He liked to pull larger boys through the playground like a tugboat.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is C, the breastfeeding. At least that's the story that Tug liked to tell later in life.
I feel like I would have been a weirdo if I would have chosen that.
Yeah. Don't worry about your reputation. Just go for your instinct.
That is such a weird story. I can't even move on.
I know. All right, next question. After recording the final out in the 1980 World Series as a pitcher for the Phillies, Tug McGraw said what? A, you guys are happy we won a world championship, but I'm happy I just made another 25 grand. B, isn't all sport, indeed all human endeavor, pointless in the face of eternity? Or C, New York can take this championship and stick it?
I'm going to say the first choice again.
You guys are happy we won a world championship, but I'm happy I just made another 25 grand? The audience.
When you repeat it back to me, it makes me feel like I've picked another wrong answer.
Yeah. Did you pick up that tone of condemnation in my voice?
Yeah, it was just right. Like, Tig, now the more I talk to you, the more I'm realizing how you failed three grades and dropped out of high school.
So you're not going to pick the first one.
Okay, the third one.
New York can take this championship and stick it?
Yes.
You're right. That's what he said. He later said he regretted that comment. He had played for some years with the New York Mets and felt bad about it. All right. Last question. If you get this one right, you win. As a young player, Tug had a relationship with a waitress and was intimate with her, he says, just one time. But that single night in the late 60s resulted in what? A lifelong habit of over-tipping. B, a vow of celibacy. Or C, the country music star Tim McGraw.
C, Tim McGraw.
You are right! Tug took off. The waitress later found out she was pregnant. And Tug never acknowledged that her son Tim was his until many years later. Carl, how did Tig Notaro do in our quiz?
Tig, you had two correct answers, so you win for Jeremy Meyer.
Well done. Tig Notaro Live is available on iTunes. Her podcast is Professor Blastoff. Tig Notaro, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thanks, Tig. Bye-bye.
Jim Gaffigan is one of the most successful stand-ups working today. He's famous for being a family man, but mostly for his enthusiasm for a certain frozen foodstuff. He joined us on July of 2013, along with Kiri, Maz, and Paula.
Now you have a new book called Dad is Fat?
Yes.
And where does that title come from?
Dad is Fat was the first sentence that my now 7-year-old son wrote on a dry erase board when he was about 4 or 5, and he showed it to me, and I laughed, and then I put him up for adoption.
Yeah. Used to have 6. And is this a book about parenting? Is this a book about being a dad?
Yeah, it's about parenting. You know, I mean, I was someone who 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, really couldn't even get a date. And it's, you know, I love my kids. I have no idea what I'm doing. I kind of set out, you know, I wrote it with my wife that we didn't want to do a book that was, I hate my kids, or we didn't want to do a book that was, I worship my kids. So it's more or less, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Right.
That's the premise.
So you write jokes with your wife? That probably sort of keeps you from doing a lot of the classic, well, let me tell you about my wife jokes.
Yeah, well, no, there's definitely, I mean, she's editing, but there is also, I mean, it's a very unique, you know, relationship that we have. And
where did you guys meet, Jim?
I bought her from Russia. We met in our neighborhood in New York City, and she would come to my shows, and she would provide suggestions, and I would be like, that's interesting. No, but then eventually the ideas were great, and I was using most of them, and now we write everything.
I still don't see how you met. You said she was in the neighborhood. Where? Where did you first lay eyes on? Where specifically?
What do you need footage?
Yeah. Is there my?
We met actually. It's called Eden Farms. It's a Korean deli on Prince Street in New York City. The
nice.
Zip code is 10012.
Okay. All right. No.
I think you're looking for a co-writer. Is
yeah,
that what you're looking for?
Yeah, I think
for?
So. Yeah.
She's going to the deli.
Fine. We've beaten around the bush enough. It's time to talk to Mr. Gaffigan about Hot Pockets. Because, as everyone knows, you went from successful to very successful when you started your routine about Hot Pockets, the delicious frozen entree. How in the world did you start with that? Where did that come from? You're eating a Hot Pocket one day and you...
I think it's very lucky. First of all, the whole Hot Pocket thing is kind of a blessing and a curse, right?
Right.
It's made it so I can perform in theaters and people have been exposed to my comedy, but I certainly don't need more drunk college kids yelling Hot Pocket at me.
Really? So you mean, because people, you need to see this routine. It's hilarious. It's extended. And so people like come out and like you're walking through a college campus and doing a show and and they come out and they go, Hot Pockets!
Yeah, no, I'll be walking with my kids down the street or in an airport and people will yell Hot Pockets and I never know how to respond.
Like, is that how you met your wife?
The irony, Paul, is she was dressed as a Hot Pocket.
I know. Do your kids know why people are calling you Hot Pocket?
Yeah. They, you know, my kids have actually never eaten a Hot Pocket. That's the irony. But, yeah, they know about the Hot Pocket thing because it's pretty unavoidable that after about 10 times, my son's like, why do they keep saying Hot Pocket?
Plus,
I said, don't ask, that's how we're paying for college.
Yeah. One last question for you. You're known for being rather pale, right?
Yes.
This is one of your things.
Yes.
And this came up, we were talking about this today, and one of our producers says, well, I'm very pale, I wonder if he glows in the dark. And we're like, do you glow in the dark? And she's like, yeah, I do, you know. I glow in the dark, I'm pale. And so the question for you, Jim Gaffigan, is do you glow in the dark?
Gosh, I suppose I do. I mean, I never really thought about it like that. That's like the first time, you know, because I grew up this kid very, you know, like, hated the fact that I was pale. And then, you know, it ended up being part of stand-up, and I came up with this thing with my brother-in-law, called Pale Force, where all these pale people are like, oh, finally someone's talking about being pale. But, you know, I'm definitely hesitant wearing shorts during the summer. Like, for a pale person, you know, summer, everyone in the world is so excited for summer, but pale people were just like, oh, no. Great.
Really? Not being particularly pale, I did not know that pale shame was a thing.
Oh, yeah. It's also hard to articulate, because you can't have pale pride because the Germans kind of messed that up.
That's true. Yeah. Well, Jim Gaffigan, we're delighted to have you here, and we have asked you here. It's true. And we've asked you to play a game we're calling
Gaffigan Meet Gwyneth Again.
All right.
It occurred to us that you have many things in common with Gwyneth Paltrow.
She's pale.
You're both, well, exactly. Yeah. You're both very pale, very attractive, successful entertainers, but you have different health habits. So we're going to ask you three questions about living life the pure Gwyneth way.
Okay.
Get two questions right, you win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their voicemail. Carl, who is Jim Gaffigan playing for?
Jim is playing for Amy Larson of Hillsboro, Oregon.
All right, ready to play, Jim?
Oh, I hate that lady.
Oh. Her?
No, she's great. She's
awesome. It's all in the past now.
Yeah.
Here's your first question. Gwyneth Paltrow believes that she is qualified to be a self-actualization guru. Well, why? A, quote, well, I'm perfect, right? What more evidence do you need, unquote? B, people have been asking her for advice since she was, as she says, in the womb. Or C, she was told so by the rocks at Red Rocks in Colorado.
Oh, hold on a second. I have to throw up. wow. Jeez. I would say it's the Red Rocks.
You're right, Jim. It is the Red Rocks. When it says... When it says, quote, I was starting to hike up the Red Rocks, and honestly, it was as if I heard the rocks say, you have the answers. You are your own teacher.
You
and
know what?
She's ours. What?
They said
Paula?
Something entirely different to me.
So Gwyneth has published a book, a diet plan, and writer Rebecca Harrington tried it earlier this year. She's going to eat like Gwyneth every day. And on day 10, she reported, A, that Gwyneth's daily air snacks were not very filling. B, that she'd gotten really defined arms from, quote, having hysterical fits every day. Or C, quote, day 10, so cold, so alone. May not survive, someone send barbecue.
Wow, I would say the second one with the great arms.
The great arms from having hysterical fits.
Yeah.
You're right. That's
wow.
what she said.
Wow, good for you.
Apparently, Gwyneth's diet sends you into anxiety. That's how Gwyneth gets her gun. So here's your last question. Gwyneth got her gun. last question. Even Gwyneth isn't perfect. Just kidding, she is. But when asked what her problem areas are, she answered, quote, what? A, my butt. B, I feel with a little work I could be even whiter. Or C, I did marry a guy from Coldplay.
isn't her, you know, her kid's uncle is Uncle Jay-Z, so I would say it's the whiter thing.
She feels with a little work she could be even whiter?
Yeah.
I love the fact you picked that. Yeah. So I'm not going to talk you out of it, but in fact it was A, my butt. There you are.
Oh, my God.
That's what she thinks. Carl, how did Jim Gaffigan do in our quiz?
Well, Jim had two correct answers, Peter, and that's good enough to win for Amy Larson.
Well done. Yeah.
Did it, man.
Jim Gaffigan is coming to a city near you. For tour dates, go to jimgaffigan.com. His latest book is Dad is Fat. Jim Gaffigan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jim.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school at wallacefoundation.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug in a Hammock, Berman, Benevolent Overlord. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our assistant house manager is Tyler Green. Our CFO is Ann Nian. Our intern is Stephen Tathias. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dalarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Eva Walchover, Miles Dernboss, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our production coordinator is Robert Approbation Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. The executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle and to all our panelists and our fabulous guests you heard today. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we will see you all next week. This is NPR.